Well, good morning, everybody. It is so bleeping cold. Oh, my word. How crazy is this? We were talking about this at breakfast the other day about how there really is, nobody made us live here. We chose to live here. Most of us, I mean, maybe some of us feel like we don't choose to live here. We're stuck here. But I mean, on this continent, more or less, you know, this is a choice. And there's so much that's beautiful about where we live. And there's some things about it that are really challenging. And we were just talking about this at supper the other night about what it would be like to live in this climate without all of these supports that we have, without being able to sort of just set the thermostat, for instance, you know, kind of incredible that from before what our European or Western trained minds think of as history, before anything was written down, long, long before, people lived in this climate and thrived in this climate. And it's kind of amazing all unto itself, and a thing worth remembering. Anyway, glad to be able to be together, and glad to be able to gather in warm spaces. Missing, as part of that upheaval that Sarah mentioned in what she wrote in Community Time, missing gathering together. Sarah, also thank you for posting that picture of whichever one of our precious littles was kind of zonked out on the chair. Yeah, so many things to miss and so many things to celebrate and be grateful for. Among the things that I feel grateful for this morning is I feel grateful to live and work and be part of a community that gathers on the original lands of the Anishinaabe, the Cree, the Oji Cree, the Dakota, and the Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. Lots of land acknowledgements at this point start to use we language. We believe we will do this and that, and especially those associated with institutions. And I know that in my position at the table, there's ways in which I am sort of the voice of a community. And yet, because it's a community of exploration, I wish to be careful about saying we about things. And so let me see if I can blend those as regards my own gratitude for some of these things. I believe that it's essential that we respect the treaties that were made on these territories. And can I just say, the more I learn about this, the more I believe that, not the other way around. I believe it's essential that we learn how to acknowledge the harms and mistakes of the past, not so that we can wallow in guilt, but so that we can be transformative participants in a process going forward that is hopeful and helpful. I believe that it's essential that we dedicate ourselves to move forward in partnership, by which I assume equal partnership, with Indigenous communities in a spirit of reconciliation and collaboration. That's what I believe, and I believe those things are important for us as a community as well, for the we of the table. I know that not everyone will have a uniform sense of that being essential, and I understand and accept that as part of the reality of life in this community or any community. It doesn't change my convictions about it, but I hope you can also hear that I wish to hold them in ways that make room both for my own understandings to grow and change and for the same to be true of all of us. So let's take a moment and breathe together. Last week, if you were here, we used a little different rhythm for our breathing, what's called a 4-7-8 rhythm. So same practice in terms of in through your nose, cradle your breath, a forceful but controlled exhale through pursed lips. Teresa called in a conversation in one of our Zoom hangs the other day, smelling the roses and blowing out candles, which I thought were really helpful images for both those parts of breathing. And we'll do four rounds of that. So four breaths in, cradle, and exhale. And and gather ourselves, at least, shall we say, spiritually, into the same space, and then we'll carry on with our exploration together. All right? Okay. Let's breathe together. If this is new to you, or if you're joining as a guest this morning, let me just reiterate that this is not an obligatory ritual at the table. It's an opportunity to do something. Everyone is welcome. Of course, no one is obliged or coerced to be a part of this. So if you choose to participate, I would encourage you to, if you're able, find somewhere where you can sit comfortably with your feet flat on the floor and just rest your hands on your thighs or in your lap, whatever feels more comfortable and at peace for you, and then we'll breathe together. Okay? Here we go. In for four. Cradle your breath for seven. Out for eight. Peace, everybody. Some of you will know this because you've been following along, but for those who don't, I want to mention that this week's Talkie Bit is part three of a series, introducing some thoughts about decolonizing in general and decolonizing religion more particularly. So a couple of things about that in general that are important in the context of the table, of this community. The first is that a series is somewhat unusual for us, not unheard of course, but just not necessarily the norm, and especially where a series where the ideas really build on one another in ways where each subsequent part of the series is deliberately expanding on previous ones. Now, because of the patterns in our community, in terms of who's available for what, when, and all those kind of things, I don't tend to work that way with ideas, but in this case, it does feel like the ideas are so big and interlocked that's the way the series kind of needs to work. I will continue to try to make each one of these talkie bits concise enough to be very engageable as a standalone unit, but because many of the ideas are, like I just mentioned, they're pretty sprawling, and they're also often working with relatively new terms and ideas for some of us, and not just for some of us, but I would say relatively new terms and ideas in the sort of, at least in the academic or kind of thought-oriented conversations about this stuff. There's emerging ideas in this conversation right now all the time. And so some of these are pretty fresh. And so because of that as well, I think it's worth our while, if we haven't been part of the previous, been able to catch previous episodes, to back up and catch up a little bit. And that could be done either here on the Facebook page, where these talkie bits stay up for some time after the live stream. But they also get archived as podcasts. And I usually try to get that podcast up very early in the week following this, usually Monday or Tuesday. They're the edited version, so the kind of community preamble at the front end, where we're just kind of checking in and transitioning, and some of that stuff isn't there, even though it's on the Facebook page. But the content of the talkie bit, if you will, is there in a listenable form. And you can either find that on our website at thetablewinnipeg.com, where you can just watch them directly in the browser. Or you can find them on Apple Podcasts, or there's a few other most podcatchers will track us down. So there you go. The second thing I want to say about is just a little bit about the religion part of the title for the series, Decolonizing Religion. The table is a small community, but for a small community, I would say it's one that has some diversity. And in particular, I would point to diversity of beliefs. We exist as a community to make room to explore what we believe. That's why we understand ourselves to be around. And let me just reiterate that we're not here to explore what we believe so that at some point it will uncover, that exploration will uncover some sort of hidden or layered statement of beliefs or statement of faith that's really the boilerplate version of what a core group within the community believes to be the last word about true belief. That is not the kind of exploring we're doing here. This is not, as I've said at other times, one of my favorite idioms for this is not paint the room whatever color you want as long as it ends up blue exploration. That's a hard space to be in sometimes, I know, but also I think a tremendously exciting one. No more about that. So part of what that means in practical terms is that not everyone in this community would feel as though they necessarily have a religion that they would call theirs at all. Never mind a religion that needs, you know, decolonizing. On the other hand, some of us might feel as though we don't want to have a religion, but we do, or that we're only just now starting to learn how deeply buried beliefs we've been formed by still linger, even if we've stopped identifying with the religions they're associated with or withholding particular aspects of those beliefs for ourselves, even if we might still name ourselves by a religious identity, so, let's say in our community most commonly Christian. We might believe we are, you know, not religious, or that we're done with religion, the so-called nones and dones that get talked about by sociologists of religion. And we might believe that we're not religious or we're done with religion, and we might still learn as we go exploring that we hold religious beliefs, or that we hold cultural beliefs that are grounded in religious beliefs, beliefs that need to change if we want to take seriously living in a world where things like justice and equality are actually the values that get enacted as a matter of course. It can be a little shocking, honestly, to especially if we've been kind of deconstructing our religious beliefs for a while, to go, I've consciously set aside belief X. I no longer hold that belief or identify with it. And then to find something in our thinking or our acting, our values, that is clearly pinned to that. That can be, that can take a little processing. So that's what I'm sort of gesturing toward there. In many ways, the very real possibility that we might hold beliefs that we don't realize are grounded in particular religious values is what we were exploring in last week's talky bit when we sort of skimmed the surface of the doctrine of discovery. The doctrine of discovery is a belief that clearly, unequivocally comes out of the history of Christian thought and belief, but which has become embedded in a lot of places, including in the structures of law in the Dominion of Canada. So when judges are making decisions about court cases having to do, for instance, with unraveling the abuse of treaties or other matters that have to do with land or with the sovereignty of First Nations peoples, in many instances, the stated rationale for decisions that favor the settler parties in those claims are based on those beliefs and values that arrived on the shores of this continent with the European explorers and settlers, people who were enacting this doctrine of discovery. All to say, we can be as non-religious as we want and still be working with religiously based colonial values. We can still be living in a system of law that works with religiously based colonial values. We don't have to identify with that religion or its history to have that be true about our everyday lives. I'm not sure how that feels to you. But I'm beginning to get the smallest inkling of how it feels to people who were already here and already had beliefs. and it doesn't feel good, in case you were wondering. All right, so last week we left off with the thought that the interlocking ideas behind the doctrine of discovery and the academic discipline of religious studies, or the study of comparative religions, that those two things and the thoughts that underpin them, those were the fuel in the engine of the so-called age of discovery, and the grounding beliefs that underpinned the assumed superiority and perceived authority of the European explorers to claim ownership of the lands that they bumped into on their journeys. And I chose bumped into in that sentence because when it comes to this continent, especially, that sort of feels like an important part of the story, you know, that the European settlers didn't hit what they were aiming at, so to speak, but they called it by the name they had in mind anyway. Now, whatever the first peoples of these lands already believed when the European explorers got here, including what they believed about land and about what those settlers called God, was categorically invalidated by those European ideas about what constituted religion and who had the right to, you know, air quotes, own land, and where the power behind that understanding was grounded. So all the beliefs that were here, the cultural, the fully formed cultures that were here, the systems of belief, the deep, wide, substantial, I feel even silly saying it, valid systems of belief that were already here were just stepped on because of those assumed ideas that the European settlers had when they got here. And I suggested that this perspective produced what we now call colonization. And that's where I want to pick up the explorations. I want to offer just a quick shout out here to a young Indigenous leader that I've just recently met, a guy named James Thunder, here in Winnipeg. James is among the people whose summaries of some of the big ideas about colonialism have given me, it feels like, just a little bit of a step up, a little bit of a first rung starting place in this huge dialogue. And James is the person who's also pointed me most directly toward the thinking and writing of Jeffrey S. Dennis, and more about Jeffrey Dennis and his work later. But first, I think it's important with big sprawling ideas to be a little bit more specific about our terms. I realize there's several ways to define almost any term. So let's say this is how I'm thinking about these terms, and that might help the things I'm talking about, have a little more context. So commonly used definition of colonization, since we're talking about decolonization, start with the problem and then move toward the solution. Commonly used definition of colonization is to absorb a nation by erasing its identity. To absorb a nation by erasing its identity. If we might prefer a definition from a frequently referenced European source, in this case the Oxford English Dictionary, it's hard to get more European than that, this is the definition in that document. Colonization is the policy or practice of acquiring full or partial political control over another country, occupying it with settlers, and exploiting it economically. The policy or practice of acquiring full or partial political control over another country, occupying it with settlers, and exploiting it economically. And I don't think it takes more than just a cursory reading of history to know that that has been the story of the so-called Age of Discovery over and over again. This is what happened on so many different continents. It might have been about furs, might have been about farmable land, might have been about spices or tobacco, it might have been about slave labor and so on. But the purpose of colonization was exploitation. It was financial expansion. It was the growth of business. And the rationale was that the European settlers, whose idea of religion centered things like the primacy of the Christian scriptures and of humankind, not all humankind, humankind primarily as defined by white men, and so European settlers had this religion that was centered on those two things and regarded them as archetypal of valid systems of belief, right? So these texts that we now think of as the Christian scriptures and this particular people group, white European men, those were regarded as the standard for a valid system of belief. And that system of belief and those who held it had the God-given right in this understanding to subjugate, colonize, and convert Asians, Africans, indigenous peoples on more than just this continent, and other groups, because beliefs that didn't fit that mold, that valid mold, were classified by scholars and clergy as inferior, or less highly developed, or even evil. So you can sort of see what's sort of happening to the scales here, right? So if, for instance, you've grown up around Christianity, and at some point in your journey in that religious setting, you've heard someone talk down to or about other systems of belief, or perhaps even call them evil, this understanding that I've just been talking about, that broad understanding was what was running, consciously or otherwise, in the background. That's what was validating that perspective, that these other belief systems were inferior. Now, here's an important idea. It's not that we can't point to any particular religion and say of some belief or practice within it, that's wrong, or that's evil, even. Of course we can. The important thing is that we can do that for every religion, including Christianity. Religion is a category. And within that category, a huge range of things exist and can be acted out. And because religions are something that we make as humans, they are subject to the full range of human behaviors. If we can keep that in mind, and this is why I'm mentioning all this, I think if we can keep that in mind, it'll help us navigate every part of this better, including the parts that might be about religions that we grew up with, or maybe even ones that we still hold dear or identify with. Where things start to go sideways is when we pick one religion, often the one we think of ourselves as being a part of or knowing the most about, and we are disinclined to deeply examine what has happened or what is happening within that religion that is also wrong or evil. And of course, within all the religions, we can also find things that are good. When we stop thinking critically about this, we're uniquely vulnerable to making assumptions of superiority, both about beliefs and about the people that hold them. So it's sort of a short step from not thinking critically about our own beliefs to assuming that they're superior, would be another way to say that. What something like the doctrine of discovery did was give people who identified as, again, air quotes, Christians, a free pass to do things that were wrong and to not see it that way, or to not think of themselves as accountable for the damage done. If you really believe that a people group is inferior, it's not that difficult to imagine how you might also understand yourself to be giving a gift to the wider world if you helped eradicate that people group. Does this sound like some of the great atrocities of human history to you? Yes, it does. But that's sort of a short sentence that captures that. We're superior. We're right. The world would be better if all things were right, wouldn't it? So, doesn't that mean we need to get rid of the things that are not right? Especially if you make it binary, right? So that's kind of how that works. Now, there's a lot more we could say on that, but I want to move on to some of the core ideas surrounding decolonization. Hopefully, we can already see that the process, having started with a set of religious ideas, needs to take on some of those same ideas if we want to see the damage addressed or the process kind of backed up to the degree that we can do that, made right. So let's start with the assumption that as settlers and indigenous peoples that share a land here on this continent, let's start with the assumption that we no longer want to exploit one another, but rather we want to work together as equals to come up with a way of living together that shows the in common values of human dignity and worth for all people. Now, I'm not so naive as to believe that everybody actually wants this. That is clearly not the case. However, I'm hopeful enough to believe it's where we're headed and that we're gaining momentum, so I'm going to work with hope. Now, if you're listening to this on the podcast, I'm going to do something that might be a little hard to visualize. But in the live stream setting, there's a feed down the left-hand side of my screen where I can see folks' comments as they pop up. And Horst just posted a comment that said, "The book I'm currently reading differentiates between Christianity and Christendom." And just a brief comment there as regards the things I'm talking about here. Yes, that is a meaningful distinction. The short version of that distinction is that Christianity is sort of the 40,000 foot umbrella, the big set of beliefs. Christendom is a particular period in history where that set of beliefs was intertwined with state. And so church and state were one. That's the period from which we get the doctrine of discovery and the idea of comparative religions based in Christian beliefs as the standard. And we get this hubris that I've been talking about. So it comes from the period in history that we would call Christendom. And that's a meaningful distinction, especially for those who wish to continue to identify as Christian, but do not wish to affirm some of the behaviors of the period of Christendom. Having said that, part of the point that I'm trying to make is that if values from Christendom as a period of history are still embedded in the laws of Canada and are still actively judging other people groups as lesser in court rulings, then I don't think we've quite shed the legacy of Christendom yet. And so that's how that intersection would function in what I'm talking about now. Back to the hope. Not that I think that wasn't connected. So On this journey toward decolonization, toward living together in ways that enact the equal value and dignity of all persons, stop number one, it seems to me, is one that examines what I believe about what I believe. And that's kind of what I've been talking about in general, but I want to focus it down a little bit, because if I or if we start with the belief that what we believe is superior to what others believe, or to use a more common word, right versus not right for other beliefs, if we start there, we have now backed the truck up to, at best, in terms of being involved in transformative change, we've backed the truck up to, at best, a conversation about diversity or accommodation rather than decolonization or reconciliation. So that's there is a discernible difference in those two conversations. Do they both have value? Can they both move this conversation forward? I think they can. But I think one of them takes it way further toward what we're after, if we're after things like equality and justice, than the other one does. Conversation about accommodation, as we explored one of the other weeks, is I'll make room for you at my table, but I still define the table because my definition of it is superior. But I'll make space for your alternative beliefs, you know. That's accommodation and diversity. Again, it has value. Is it the same as equal partners? Let's talk about how we're going to do this together. It's not the same. So anyway, if you want to explore the difference between diversity and decolonization, last week's talky bit unpacks that a little bit more, but still at a very introductory level. Now, some of the things I'm saying here might sound a bit strong, but I want to encourage us to think about this for a moment. It's the belief that they were categorically right about their notions of God, country, and human worth based on adherence to particular doctrines or dogmas that fueled the hubris of the Age of Discovery, that meant that someone could land on a piece of earth they had never seen before. They could encounter a fully developed society there, including what we would use words like religion for, and they could declare that whole thing that they found invalid in the name of God. Were the European explorers open to learning from the indigenous peoples? Well, if they hadn't been, they probably wouldn't have made it through the first winter on the continent, the first week that was like this one, you know? They would have died. They didn't know what they were doing. But being open to learning from someone doesn't mean you regard them as your equal. It can be that. Being open to learning from someone else might be understood that way. I'm learning from my equal, but it can just as well be another sort of more personal form of exploitation. So for example, I have the right to take from you whatever I want to take is only a short step away from, I believe I'll start with your knowledge of how to survive in this place. If I am taking something so that I can exploit it, I'm oppressing the person from whom I am taking that thing, even if they gave it to me willingly and in good faith. It's on me, the taker, if I'm assuming a position of superiority as a starting place. We're not talking about this today, but that's a reasonably workable short version of the different ways indigenous peoples and European settlers viewed treaties. And it can help us if we're wrestling with determining when something might be considered cultural appropriation, for instance. It's one way to sort of benchmark that complicated idea. It's also something that's true in all human relationships, including ones in which race is not a factor. So it's pretty pervasive. And in some ways, it's how common this kind of experience is that makes us vulnerable to not noticing it's happening, whether it's happening around us or inside of us. It's ubiquitousness. It's found everywhereness that makes it hard to see. And this fact about that aspect of belief is what has led to concepts such as what is called laissez-faire racism. And this is where we come across the research of people like Jeffrey S. Dennis, whom I mentioned earlier. Dennis is currently an associate professor at McMaster University in the faculties of social psychology and sociology. And he is the author of a quite new book entitled Canada at a Crossroads, Boundaries, Bridges, and Laissez-faire Racism in Indigenous-Settler Relations. Like any good academic book, it's got a nice long descriptive title. I don't know if you've ever felt that kind of click when you hear or read something that offers a framework for experiences that you've been having maybe your whole life, it's a powerful thing to have that experience, right? It's exciting, it's illuminating, it's encouraging maybe, and it's also potentially just a bit hazardous. And I would add that last caution, first of all, for myself, because I know how appealing it is to run across an idea that offers an explanation for your experiences and to sort of lock onto it and stop exploring, to kind of go, that's it, that's the answer, I've got it. I've got the final superior idea about this. And so it's sort of the same kind of thinking, but new information, right? Inserted in the blank. So for example, when it comes to Jeffrey Dennis's ideas or the broader sort of sociological framework of laissez-faire racism, one of the critiques that is leveled regularly at that realm of thinking and that approach is that it's essentially too kind or too gentle to actually produce the needed changes. So kind of like, yep, that's nice for you folks that are in your academic ivory towers, but if you were on the street, you know, you'd find out that this just hasn't got enough muscle to it to actually produce change. So just so you know, I'm going to offer a couple of Jeffrey Dennis's ideas here for our consideration. I'm going to explore some of those a little bit more next week. I offer all of that with the caveat that really these ideas are the tip of the iceberg. They're not the last word, but I've found them helpful and you've given me some time to talk about all of this, so I'm going to explore those. One of the things about Dennis's work that I appreciate and that I resonate with is that its context is Canadian, and in particular, small town Canadian. The title of his doctoral dissertation, which was the starting point for the book that I mentioned, but the title of the dissertation is Contact Theory in Small Town Settler Colonial Context, the Reproduction of Laissez-Faire Racism in Indigenous White Canadian Relations. Now, I want to read you the abstract from that published piece, because it's like a good abstract. It pulls a bunch of things together, but you have to brace yourself for just a little bit of jargon, because he is, after all, a sociologist, and this is that realm of work that he's doing academically. But not to worry, we'll pick some of that up in a moment. So here's the abstract for that article. This article builds on group position theory and the subcategorization model of intergroup contact by illustrating how, in a small town settler colonial context, contact, so contact between the groups, tends to reproduce rather than challenge the inequitable racial structure. In northwestern Ontario, Indigenous settler relations are characterized by widespread intergroup marriage and friendship, as well as pervasive prejudice and discrimination. Using 18 months of fieldwork and 160 interviews and surveys with First Nations, Métis, and non-Indigenous residents, I show that although contact is associated with less, he quotes, old-fashioned prejudice, i.e. overt categorical hostility, it does not necessarily eliminate white's superior sense of group position. Even white individuals who have close Indigenous friends or spouses often express laissez-faire racism. Three mutually reinforcing social processes, subtyping, ideology-based homophily, and political avoidance norms, interact to sustain white's sense of group superiority and justifications for racial inequity. These processes are facilitated by historical and structural conditions, in this case, colonization and small-town dynamics. Okay, just so we don't get lost in the technical terms, what he's generally on about here is the idea that we can be deeply embedded in cultural contexts where there's lots of contact between people groups. We can be as deeply embedded as intermarriage. So that's kind of the classic, if you're listening to Black folks, especially from the U.S., talk about Black issues around Black racism in America. One of the illustrations they like to use is people kind of going, I can't be a racist. I got a Black brother-in-law, right? That's sort of the, if you will, more typical American version of what Dennis is describing here in a northwestern Ontario Canadian setting. So we can be deeply embedded culturally as intermarriage, for instance, and still regard the people group we're from as superior and justifiable in attitudes and actions and policies that are inequitable. We can have both those things at the same time. And in fact, he's making a case for the idea that the ongoing contact between people groups can reinforce the exact things that launched those problems in the first place. All right, so next week we're going to unpack those three terms a little bit. It's not the only thing we'll do, but we'll do some of that. So we'll explore ways in which an idea like subtyping or ideology-based homophily or political avoidance norms can actually foster the problem rather than reducing the problem, even where there's lots of intergroup contact between, in this particular case, between settlers and settler colonial folks and First Nations and Indigenous peoples. One of the things that we will learn when we do that exploration is that, like lots of academic language, these terms are actually describing common experiences. And if we kind of figure out, if we kind of get past the terms and talk about what they're pointing toward, one of the things we'll see is that they can help give us what might be new or more focused ways of thinking about experiences that we've already had or that we're having ongoing. When I was just a kid, I don't remember how old I was. I imagine I was maybe 11, 12, somewhere in there. I can remember I was working with my dad in his carpentry shop one day. And I don't remember what the project was, but he was doing something with a chisel, a wood chisel, and it slipped. And it cut what I remember being a pretty deep gash in the heel of his hand. He'd been working with his hands. They were blood suffused. There was a lot of blood. I remember a lot of blood. In any event, the other thing I remember is him cleaning and bandaging his cut and then taking his chisel over to the grinder to sharpen it. And in my kid brain, you know, that was a little bit counterintuitive, right? I'm like, if you make it sharper, like, aren't you just putting yourself in greater danger of injury? Won't it just cut you quicker, deeper, more severely? Like, isn't a sharp tool more dangerous than a dull tool? Most of us have already learned, of course, that this is not the way that it works, that a sharp chisel will cut quicker and deeper, and it needs to be handled with respect and acquired skill, but it is much less likely to slip and do harm. And so, on balance, it's less dangerous than a dull one. And of course, if you're in the business of patching up cuts, you'll also know that the sharp cut tends to be more patchable than the cut made by something dull. Ideas can be like that as well, right? And this is partly why we explore what we believe, to sharpen our ideas, to sharpen our thoughts, to refine our beliefs. Not so that they will be more dangerous, but so that they will be less dangerous. Not so that they will do greater harm, but so that they will do less. We do this, among other things, so that we can be effective. We can be transformative or part of something transformative, so that we can be part of conversations and actions and communities and movements that whittle away at the structures of injustice with more precision, with more effectiveness, and also with more kindness, and that do less clumsy collateral damage. I want to leave us today with a couple of further thoughts, sort of musable thoughts, I hope, about decolonization. If colonialism and colonial structures take away cultural freedom, as well as psychological and economic freedom, I think it's fair to say that they choke the life out of whoever is being oppressed. That's true wherever such structures exist, including in religion and spiritualities. It's also true that resistance against such structures can exist within religions. So, for instance, if you happen to be someone that takes the teachings of Jesus seriously, whether you do that from a particular religious standpoint or from a sort of broader cultural one, it's worth remembering that at the heart of those teachings is an unapologetic commitment to justice and peace for everyone. The Hebrew story, in which the Christian story stands, has that same theme. If you have cultural power, you'll find this idea over and over again in the Hebrew scriptures. If you have cultural power, The reason you have it is so you can extend it, so you can share it as care, not so you can lord it over others, to use a particular sacred text phrase. That's not necessarily, if you think of the reactions, for example, to Jesus' teachings, not necessarily a particularly popular message that this is for everyone. It's also not what I would think of as mission accomplished, not while so many live with such profoundly unjust and oppressive realities. I think it's unfinished business generally, and I think it's unfinished business religiously, culturally. I read someone this week who posed a question that is really sticking with me, and I'm going to leave it with us to muse about. It's a question I've been trying to remember to ask myself and finding helpful in the process, and it uses a phrase that I found really interesting that I'll point to when we get there. Here's the question. In what ways has colonialism taught me to stand by, that is, to be idle? In what ways has colonialism taught me to stand by in an institutional uniform of the mind and watch the choking, rather than actively participating in the dismantling of such structures, both within and around me? By such structures, we're referring here to structures that choke out psychological, cultural, and economic freedom. It's that phrase, uniform of the mind, I think, that kind of stirred something for me, where I was like, it's pretty easy to point to uniforms as symbols of certain power structures, right? I mean, it's partly the conversation we're having around an institution like policing at this moment in history. There are also ways in which we do that in our thinking, that we dress our thinking up in certain symbols, in certain uniforms. And those uniforms, we behave, even if we're not thinking of it, we behave as though those uniforms somehow protect us or give us an innate authority or a place of vertical superiority in cultural setting and cultural framework. In what ways has colonialism taught me to stand by in an institutional uniform of the mind and watch the choking, rather than actively participating in the dismantling of such structures, both within and around me? Can't speak for anybody else on this one, but I can tell you flat out for myself, every day it feels like I'm discovering a new layer to that onion, just how embedded some of those uniforms of the mind are, and how they influence me towards standing idly by rather than being involved in the dismantling of structures that oppress. I don't know if that's your story, but I suspect that to some degree it's a story most of us have in common. Anyway, however you feel about that opinion, it seems like a question that is worth applying as part of exploring what we believe and as we continue down this path a little further next week. Thanks for hanging around. Thanks for listening. Thanks for thinking. Thanks for exploring what you believe. Thanks for being part of a community that does this. I feel like we are participating in an incredibly, unreasonably privileged conversation when we do this. That we get to do this is a remarkable gift and to us and something to cherish and make the most of. I really believe that. Peace. Bye for now.